the Guinness World Records. They replied to us saying they will investigate within 90 days.
The tiny cow has also caused tourist frenzy in the South Asian country as thousands are flocking to Dhaka to take a glance despite coronavirus restrictions. The owner says only over 15,000 people come to visit her in just 3 days. The dwarf cow has also gone viral on social media. A nearly 22-meter-high sand sculpture in Denmark has set a new Guinness record as the world's tallest sand castle. The sculpture has been constructed with nearly 5 tons of sand. It's made in the shape of a triangle, and a wood structure stabilizes it. More than 30 artists from different countries have worked on the project, carving intricate details on the castle's wall. Its makers say a nod to the coronavirus pandemic was also made at the top of that construction. They say that's because the virus has controlled the lives of people over the past months. The sand piece broke the previous Guinness record that belonged to an 18-meter-high sand castle in Germany. An adorable baby elephant has become a web celebrity after she was caught on camera using a muddy hill as playground slide. Footage shows the little elephant excitedly approaching a hill with a smooth path leading downward. The baby then goes on all fours to have the time of her life sliding on her belly down the hill, taking full advantage of rain. The toddler, named Yishong, is only 3 years old. She lives at a rescue center in China, one of the major habitats for wild Asian elephants in the country.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Studies find that overall risk of death or severe disease from COVID-19 is very low in kids, says Heidi Ledford, researcher, in an article published under the heading Death from COVID, Incredibly Rare Among Children. Stay tuned for more. Studies find that overall risk of death or severe disease from COVID-19 is very low in kids. A comprehensive analysis of hospital admissions and reported deaths across England suggests that COVID-19 carries a lower risk of dying or requiring intensive care among children and young people than was previously thought. In a series of preprints published on MedRxiv 1-3, a team of researchers picked through all hospital admissions and deaths reported for people younger than 18 in England. The studies found that COVID-19 caused 25 deaths in that age group between March 2020 and February 2021. About half of those deaths were in individuals with an underlying complex disability with high healthcare needs, such as tube feeding or assistance with breathing. The studies did not evaluate rates of less severe illness or debilitating long COVID symptoms that can linger months after the acute phase of the infection has passed. The low rate of severe acute disease is important news, but this does not have to mean that COVID does not matter to children, says pediatrician Daniele Bonsenso at the Gemelli University Hospital in Rome. Please let's keep attention as much as is feasible on immunization. In one of the preprints, the researchers trawled for published accounts of COVID-19 among children and young people and ultimately analyzed data from 57 studies and 19 countries. They then picked apart risk factors for severe diseases and death from the data. Some conditions, including obesity and cardiac or neurological conditions, were associated with a higher risk of death or intensive care treatment, the researchers found. But the absolute increase in risk was very small. Study author Rachel Harwood, a pediatric surgical registrar at Alder Hey Children's Hospital in Liverpool, UK, told reporters at a media briefing. For the other two preprints, the researchers focused on England, drawing on nationwide healthcare data on intensive care admissions and deaths among those under 18 years old. The team found that of 6,338 hospital admissions for COVID-19, 259 children and young people required treatment in pediatric intensive care units. Black children were more likely than their white counterparts to require intensive care, both for COVID-19 and for pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, a rare syndrome associated with coronavirus infection. But overall, the need for intensive care was incredibly rare among these patients, says the study author Joseph Ward of the University College London Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health. of 3,105 deaths from all causes among the 12 million or so people under 18 in England between March 2020 and February 2021, 25 were attributable to COVID-19, a rate of about 2 for every million people in this age range. None had asthma or type 1 diabetes, the authors note, and about half had conditions that put them at a higher risk than healthy children of dying from any cause. Taken together, the unusually comprehensive studies could provide some comfort to parents who have been shielding children who they thought might be vulnerable to severe complications from COVID-19. There is a general feeling among pediatricians that probably too many children were shielded during the first wave of the pandemic. Russell Weiner, who studies adolescent health at the University of College London, told reporters. In some cases, those efforts might have done more harm than good, added Elizabeth Whittaker, an infectious disease specialist at Imperial College London. Shields are very leaky, she said. The shields have not been perfect and have probably caused more stress and anxiety for families than benefit. The work does not tackle the specter of long COVID, but other studies suggest that it does occur in children, including in those who had mild initial symptoms or were asymptomatic, but less frequently than in adults. Despite the very low death and intensive care rates, Bonsenso hopes that the schools will embrace measures such as masks and improved ventilation, and that parents will focus on immunization for either their children where possible or themselves. When adults are immunized, fewer children are infected, he says. We need to do as much as possible to reduce COVID-19 infection in children.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel, but former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba, in a blatant violation of international law. Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba. Beginning with the Bay of Pigs, they launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade,
including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and a surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
When it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassin squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke, these threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest the people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain Al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including Al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
This treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of humanity, against humanity, whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The Mujahideen Khalq group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference that drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian Prime Minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US, that often claim to be anti-terrorism, rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interest to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West's support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Following years of warnings and mounting fears among scientists, terrifying research revealed that climate change and deforestation have turned parts of the Amazon basin, a crucial sink, into a source of planet-heating carbon dioxide, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article titled "Biggest Story in the World Right Now." Humanity has flipped Amazon from carbon sink to source. Stay tuned for more. Following years of warnings and mounting fears among scientists, terrifying research revealed recently that climate change and deforestation have turned parts of the Amazon basin, a crucial sink, into a source of planet-heating carbon dioxide. Though recent research has elevated concerns about the Amazon putting more CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than it absorbs, The new findings, published in the journal Nature, were presented as a first by scientists and climate reporters. From 2010 to 2018, researchers from the new study, led by Luciana Gatti of Brazil's National Institute for Space Research, conducted vertical profiling measurements of carbon dioxide and monoxide a few miles above the tree canopy at four sites in Amazonia. The researchers found that southeastern Amazonia in particular acts as a net carbon source, and total carbon emissions are greater in eastern Amazonia than in the western part. The former, they noted, has been subjected to more deforestation, warming, and moisture stress than the latter in recent decades. The New York Times reported recently, in an accompanying article in Nature, Scott Denning, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University, wrote that the paper's atmospheric profiles show that the uncertain future is happening now. In an emailed response to questions, Dr. Denning praised the new study as the first real large-scale measurement from various altitudes across thousands of kilometers and remote sectors of the phenomenon, and advance beyond the traditional measurements at forest sites. The results show that warming and deforestation in eastern Amazonia have reversed the carbon sink at regional scale, and that the change is actually showing up in the atmospheric CO2, he wrote. Gatti told The Guardian that the first very bad news is that forest burning produces around three times more CO2 than the forest absorbs. The second bad news is that the places where deforestation is 30% or more show carbon emissions 10 times higher than where deforestation is lower than 20%. According to the newspaper, which noted the role of emissions from deliberately set fires for beef and soy production, as well as the global criticism that Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has faced for encouraging the soaring deforestation. Fewer trees meant less rain and higher temperatures, making the dry season even worse for the remaining forests, she said. We have a very negative loop that makes the forest more susceptible to uncontrolled fires. Much of the timber, beef, and soy from the Amazon is exported from Brazil. We need a global agreement to save the Amazon, Gatti said. European nations have said they will block an EU trade deal with Brazil and other countries unless Bolsonaro agrees to do more to tackle Amazonian destruction. The study comes after a March analysis published in the journal Frontiers in Forest and Global Change that took into account not only CO2, but also methane, nitrous oxide, black carbon, biogenic volatile organic compounds, aerosols, evapotranspiration, and albedo. The new findings also follow an April study published in Nature Climate Change that focused on Brazil, which is home to the majority of the incredibly biodiverse and threatened rainforest that spans nine countries. Comparing that research to the recent ones, Denning said that they are complementary studies with radically different methods that come to very similar conclusions. Researchers from the April study who relied on satellite monitoring found that between 2010 and 2019, the Brazilian Amazon released 16.6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, while only taking in 13.9 billion tons, meaning that over a decade, it released nearly 20% more CO2 than it absorbed. We have expected it, but it is the first time that we have figures showing that the Brazilian Amazon has flipped and is now a net emitter, said co-author Jean-Pierre Vigneron, a scientist at France's National Institute for Agronomic Research, INRA, at the time, adding, "We don't know at what point the changeover could become irreversible." Agence France-Presse reported that in a statement about the study, INRA said that Brazil saw a sharp decline in the application of the environmental protection policies after the change of government in 2019, referencing when Bolsonaro was sworn in as president. "Imagine if we could prohibit fires in the Amazon, it could be a carbon sink," Gatti said recently, noting the negative impact of converting swathes of the rainforest last for agriculture. "But we are doing the opposite. We are accelerating climate change." Communique.
The People's Mujahideen of Iran, also known as the MEK or MKO, is a very controversial group with a controversial past. Banned in Iran and Iraq, it once stood on the United States list of terrorist organizations, worked with Saddam Hussein, helped the Israelis, and is now exiled in Albania, receiving funding from Saudi Arabia. The group's number one goal is to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran through violent means and install a new government. In Iran, the group has killed thousands of civilians, assassinated dozens of high-ranking government officials, and even targeted Americans and other foreigners too. They claim to stand for human rights and democracy. But are they really the democratic opposition to Iran that they market themselves as? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The People's Mujahideen of Iran, also called the MEK or MKO, first started out in Iran as a political group in the 1960s, with its ideology initially rooted in Marxism, feminism, and Islamism. The group was anti-US, taking a harsh stance against Western ideology and capitalism. It opposed the Shah, the U.S.-backed puppet ruler of Iran at the time. And the MEK was initially made up largely of students and middle-class Iranians. During the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the group did play a role in the overthrow of the Shah. However, the degree to which they helped accomplish this appears to be somewhat exaggerated by the MEK. In the first days of the Islamic Republic, the MEK suffered numerous political defeats in Iran. It opposed the country's draft constitution and boycotted its referendum in 1979, a referendum which ultimately passed and was approved by a majority of Iranians. The group was consequently not allowed to participate in the presidential elections and took a huge loss in parliamentary elections, failing to win even a single seat. After failing to gain any traction and coming out of the legislative and electoral process with no viable path forward, the MEK began threatening to take up arms against the Islamic Republic and commenced a ruthless bombing campaign across Iran. On June 28, 1981, the MEK blew up the headquarters of the Islamic Republican Party. This massive explosion killed 72 officials, including the Chief Justice and Party Secretary Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who also played a pivotal role in the Islamic Revolution. Among the 72 martyred were four cabinet ministers, the ministers of health, transport, telecommunications, and energy, as well as 27 members of Iran's parliament, the Mejlis, and other important political and military figures in Iran. This terrorist attack is known as the Haftatir bombing. The MEK has neither denied nor confirmed responsibility, although their responsibility for the attack is commonly accepted both inside Iran and outside, as the group has publicly approved of this attack, and even the United States government itself cited this terrorist attack in a 2005 country report on Iran. 2 months later, in August 1981, the MEK bombed the offices of then Prime Minister Mohammad Jawad Bahonar. The explosion killed both the Prime Minister, the Chief of Police, and the President, Mohammad Ali Rajai. The group's violence has not just been limited to Iranians and has even targeted foreigners. By the U.S. own admission, during the 1970s, the MEK killed three U.S. Army colonels as well as three U.S. contractors. The group has also tried to assassinate the general command of the U.S. military mission and attacked numerous facilities in Iran belonging to American companies such as Pepsi, Shell Oil, Pan Am Airlines, General Motors, and more. During Saddam Hussein's violent war against Iran from 1980 to 1988, Iran was attacked by Iraq, who was supported at the time both by the Americans and the British, who had given Saddam Hussein chemical weapons. During this period, Saddam Hussein allied himself with the MEK and incorporated them into his assault against Iran, providing the group with weaponry, money, and logistical support. This proved to be yet another huge mistake on the MEK's part. Not only did their violent plans to overthrow the Iranian government fail to materialize, but the fact that they had begun working with Saddam Hussein made their reputation even worse, causing them to effectively lose all support domestically. This earned them the nickname Munafiqeen, or hypocrites. Their actions were seen as treasonous, for they had now sided with a foreign country and taken up arms with Saddam against their fellow countrymen in Iran. This would end up becoming a common theme for the MEK, for although the organization claims to be fighting for Iranians, it is in fact not based in Iran. After being exiled, the group relocated from Iran to France, from France to Iraq, and now finds itself in Albania. Knowing that it lacks any popular support at home, during the last decades, the MEK has enjoyed varying levels of support from foreign governments. This includes financial backing as well as logistical, political, and military support, not just from Saddam's Iraq, but also from other Arab countries and Western countries too. Although the MEK was once listed as a terrorist organization in the US and UK, this is no longer the case. Several US politicians, lawmakers, and military officials have participated in or attended MEK events and received thousands of dollars from the group. A Guardian investigation from 2012 shows how several key figures in the US, ranging from lawmakers, former officials, and DC lobby groups, were the recipients of large sums of money from the MEK. The MEK sought to bribe them into delisting the organization as a terror group, and these efforts ultimately proved to be successful when former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton removed the MEK from the US list of terrorist groups in 2012. Since then, the cash flow has not ceased, as we've seen more recently former New York mayor and Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, as well as former National Security Advisor John Bolton, both taking money from the MEK. In present times, Saudi Arabia is widely considered to be the group's largest financial backer. And if working with Saddam Hussein wasn't enough, the MEK has also cooperated with the Israelis on numerous occasions against Iran. In recent times, the MEK fabricated claims that Tehran was pursuing a nuclear weapons program and assisted the Israelis in fabricating and disseminating false documents to that effect. Between the years 2010 and 2012, Israel is known to have carried out the assassinations of several prominent nuclear scientists in Iran. The MEK was involved in those killings and received funding, financing, and training from the Israelis. The latest assassination in late 2020 of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is also believed to have been carried out by the Israelis, again in cooperation with the MEK. Now, with President-elect Raisi's landslide victory, the MEK has attempted to renew its efforts against Iran and rally more people around its cause. The group cites Raisi's long-term career in the judiciary as a point of contention. However, it admits recently in the press that it doesn't matter who had won the election because they are opposed to everyone. After all, the stated goal of the MEK is to overthrow the Islamic Republic in its entirety, and they deem all political movements in Iran, whether principalist or moderate or reformist, to be the same in their view. And in order to help them do that, they're willing to enlist the help of foreign governments in Europe, in America, and have been more than willing to use their help in subverting and attacking the Islamic Republic. On the weekend of July 10th, 2021, the so-called Free Iran World Summit taking place. This is a three-day online event promoting the MEK and its movement to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's basically a get-together between MEK members and foreign politicians where they collectively bash Iran, call its elections fraudulent, which is convenient given that the MEK has never won a single seat in parliament, and repeat the usual propaganda about a nuclear weapons program that doesn't exist, and so on. Now, leading the MEK's event is the current head, Maryam Rajavi. This event includes speakers such as former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the former Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs, the former Prime Minister of Albania. Also speaking at the event are dozens of U.S. senators and House members from both the Democratic and Republican parties, including Senators Robert Menendez, Ted Cruz, Roy Blunt, Ben Cardin, and Congressmen Kevin McCarthy and Hakeem Jeffries. Also present is General James Jones, who used to be President Obama's National Security Advisor, and several former European ministers, including the former foreign ministers of France, Italy, Poland, the former British and French defense ministers, and the leader of Europe's People's Party, the largest in Europe. What I've just read to you is straight from the event's website. As you can see, this is a long, long list of high-ranking officials, foreign dignitaries, and lawmakers from all across the Western world who clearly have no problem attending the event of a terrorist group that has literally assassinated an Iranian president, an Iranian prime minister, dozens of government officials, and taken up arms with Israel against their own countrymen in Iran. Then these Western politicians, in the same breath, have the gall to call Iran a terrorist state as they literally sit and speak with terrorists themselves. After all, are we surprised? This is no different from seeing Senator John McCain posing with Al-Qaeda fighters after illegally entering Syria, or Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, and so on and so forth. Bipartisanship for regime change is always there, and the United States and its allies literally make money from sponsoring terrorism. That's all their foreign policy is, overthrowing governments and countries they don't like so that they can steal their land and control their resources. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me to discuss more is Anne-Hoda Bande. She's an expert on the methodology of radicalization and cultic abuse and terrorism. Thank you so much for taking the time, Anne. It's a pleasure to have you on.
You're welcome.
The MEK, or the People's Mujahideen, they've moved headquarters several times in the last years. They're currently based in Albania. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that, how it came to be that they've moved headquarters several times and what they're doing in Albania right now?
Well, I'll just skip back 20 years with the invasion of Iraq. And, of course, Mujahideen were hand-in-hand with the Saddam regime. And so they had a massive base there, a military base, and they were sort of launching attacks into Iran from Iraq. That all ended, of course, in 2003, and they were corralled into one base, disarmed by the US Army, and sort of left while everybody figured out what to do with them. From there, from Camp Ashraf in the Diyali province, they went to a base just outside Baghdad with a view to actually moving them out of the country. Of course, in the meantime, Maryam Rajavi was in Paris. She came over there 30 years ago, but the main body of the organization had been stuck in Iraq for three decades since the revolution. Hillary Clinton managed to persuade the Albanian government at the time, the Prime Minister was Salih Berisha, and said, you know, we'll take this organisation on. So that was the deal. That was the deal in 2013. In 2016, they started sending people there. Maryam Rajavi continued in France. Every major city, Europe, North America, had a kind of a cell of the MEK. The people who came to Albania did so essentially without any ID documents. The UNHCR, which was actually responsible for moving them, gave each of them a document which said, I am being transferred for humanitarian reasons. And they just basically had their name, whichever name they chose to give, because a lot of them came with false names, and it's actually not known exactly who they are, although most of them are known to, you know, the intelligence services of all the countries that they're in. So they ended up as a group in Albania. Now, the reason Mariam Rajavi is now in Albania holding her meeting is because she's been expelled from Europe. That was 2018. I think things came to a head with the intelligence services. They assessed this group in their sphere, the EU, as a risk.
Right. I mean, we recall that several U.S. officials are on the payroll of the MEK, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she removed them off the list of terrorist organizations. Does the United States have a long-term agenda at play here in supporting the MEK?
Simple answer, yes. You know, the Americans, well, I say support, and Americans' involvement with the Mujahideen goes way, way back to after they left Iran, after the revolution, they were pushed out. And it was, in fact, the French CIA who sort of brokered a deal with France to take them there, give them a base, give them some land, let them sort of establish a headquarters there. And I'm sure somewhere along the line you'll find the name Donald Rumsfeld among those deals that took place. Yeah, what a guy. And also, you know, Donald Rumsfeld basically gifted the MEK to Saddam Hussein. France was saying, well, you know, I don't want these people. What can we do? So they sent Massoud Rajavi, who was leader at the time, to Iraq. The Americans have kind of kept them at arm's length. None of the top leaders have ever been allowed into America. Mariam Rajavi was desperate to try and get in. Back in 94, 95, 96, she came back to Europe. America has refused her a visa all that time. The UK managed to kind of give her a short sort of overnight trip to have a meeting and then sent her straight back to France. And France has tolerated her because it had to. But all this time, yes, the anti-Iran American European crowd have found the Mujahideen a very useful kind of tool to amplify their agenda, to pass off information like the nuclear revelations. And you will find, yes, that they have been, I mean, people like John Bolton, although people like him are paid for meetings, and it's quite open that the Mujahideen pay these people, but very often they're quite actually, you know, they really believe that the Mujahideen are sort of an opposition group and can overthrow the regime and make a difference to the situation there. So yes, the American involvement, and it isn't just the Republicans, the Democrats, it's a bipartisan support, and it's in individuals rather than government. The only government in the world after Saddam Hussein who has actually supported the Mujahideen has been Albanian government, unfortunately.
Right. And I mean, just generally speaking, what would you say is the current level of support that they enjoy from the Biden administration and other European countries or Arab countries at the moment?
In terms of the Biden administration, I sincerely hope that there's a memo gone out from the Defense Department and the Department of State to sort of say, look, you know, drop this group. Certainly, I think among the actual officials in those ministries, there's a very sort of profound understanding that this group is not, it's a toxic group and it shouldn't be supported. And the only people who do continue to support them are paid. As we'll see in the meeting today. In Europe, again, you know, the Mujahideen made themselves so impossible by constantly invading the European Parliament, harassing MEPs, lobbying, you know, left, right and centre. And it, I think it was a sense of relief when they were actually sent out of the European Union and kind of, you know, they no longer have to tolerate this interference in their foreign affairs and such like.
You know, when you mention this meeting, and you know, we are also talking about the Free Iran Global Summit that's being held. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about this and what exactly?